Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Names. Three parallel storylines unfold based on what name an Irish mother decides to give her son. It's a great premise, and it's been described as a dazzling debut by the writer Florence Knapp, and the book is tipped to be a book club holiday read favourite. Florence Knapp is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Oh, no, you're very well. And congratulations on this. It's a stunning novel. And there's a lot of talk about this. Are you OK? Because people have been talking about this for about 6 months.
It does feel very surreal, but really wonderful as well. I've written a previous novel that didn't find a home. Mm-hmm. And so I think all I wanted for this one was for it to exist in the world as a real tangible thing. But it's been lovely to have had such a kind of fantastic early response to it from certainly within the publishing industry.
Yeah, there were a 13-way bidding war. Can you explain to people not in the books industry what that essentially means?
I didn't know what any of this meant before I went into it either. But I just wanted one publisher to want my novel. It was kind of just wonderful to have more than that wanting it. But it's essentially that your agent takes out your novel to different publishers, and then they kind of say whether they're interested and enter an auction if more than one are interested. And during the auction process, we went round and met with each of the publishers who was interested. That felt like a kind of week in my life that was so surreal and so far from, my own life really, because it's, as a writer, I've kind of naturally drawn towards a quite quiet life. It felt very other.
So 13 different companies fought it out, and this one obviously won it out. Your previous books that were published, can you tell people what they were about?
Yeah, so I have published a non-fiction book about English paper piecing, which is a really traditional method of hand sewing, mm-hmm. It sounds extraordinary, but you wrap bits of fabric around shapes like hexagons and then use that as a structure to sew them together and then take the paper out afterwards. Sorry, that's probably way too much detail.
No, I love the fact that you were writing about quilting and sewing, these lovely English crafts, and then you've come out with this sensational novel that everyone is talking about. It's a nice story for yourself.
Well, I think my book, the second half of it focused on the techniques around that craft, but the first half of it was more focused on the psychology of why we work with our hands and what it means to us to do that, and why it kind of, you know, the benefits to us as people. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways it feels like it taps into my novel, because there are so many makers and artisans who kind of pop up as characters throughout the names.
It's a huge part of it, and particularly the Irish part of it, which we're delighted to
yes,
talk about.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yes.
Because you're new to the scene, this novel world, everyone's going to get to know the name Florence Knapp. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Are you from England?
Yes, I'm from England, although when I was six, I moved to Australia for a couple of years because of my father's work. But I have spent the rest of my life in England, and I live just outside London with my husband and have two grown-up children. Who are kind of my daughter's home for a little bit for a moment, so we're enjoying having her back. But yeah, no, they're off out in the world doing their own thing now.
And like a lot of people nowadays in the public eye, you've decided to keep your children's names private, which is, I think, significant considering that it's a novel about names.
Sorry, the line's gone a bit.
Oh, sorry, apologies. I was just talking about the names.
You're back again.
You've decided to keep your own grown-up children's names private as you go into the limelight. And I think that's curious given that you've written a novel about names.
Yeah, I think it feels very much like your name is very much the, you know, it's this collection of vowels and consonants that you very much live within, and it's hard to tell where one thing ends and the other begins. And I guess that I wanted to leave my children's names to just be defined by them and the things they want to do in the world, rather than kind of my book. And I mean, they're very happy to be named and kind of would have embraced that. But I think I feel as their parent that I really want their names to be just things that they exist in themselves, where they kind of form the story that's, you know, their name.
I think it's a nice idea. Were you named after Florence Nightingale?
No, it was funny, actually. My mum always used to say to me, you weren't named after Florence Nightingale. Apparently, she wasn't actually very nice at times. So, no, I was named after, there was a French stop motion animation called The Magic Roundabout in the 1970s, when my mum was pregnant. Yeah. And I was named after a character called Florence in there just because... my mum loved her shoes. She had these enormous white shoes that were lace-ups, and my mum thought they were so quaint and sweet and part of the whole French appeal of the programme, and so I was called Florence after her.
That's as good a reason as any. Is your name shortened yeah. sometimes?
No, it's funny. I think we're all so different in that way, aren't we? But yeah. it's to me, when someone shortens my name, it feels slightly like they've kind of reached across and adjusted my hair or kind of removed my scarf or something. And I'm left thinking, God, I wanted those letters. Give them back.
Yeah.
Because it's I feel very much like I feel like a Florence. And so when someone says Flo, I like the name, but I don't recognise myself in it.
I see. They've kind of given you a completely different name, even though it's
part yeah, of it. Yes. Yeah, it's a bit like if they'd call me Brian, it feels that kind of level of kind of, oh, that's not actually my name.
So here you are anyway with the names. Will you tell us what it's all about? Because I'm afraid to give things away because things happen so quickly early on. It's hard to know what I can give away. So you will be the arbiter of that.
Okay. So it's a sliding doors what-if style novel that looks at how the name we're given can shape the course of a person's life. And it spans 35 years, and it opens in the wake of the 1987 storm, which I don't know whether that hit Ireland in the same way that it hit the UK, but it was our biggest storm for over 200 years and came almost completely without warning. So when Cora sets out to name her child the morning after this storm, the world's already in complete disarray. Her husband is expecting her to name their child after him, because that's kind of a long-standing family tradition for him. And he's a very well-respected doctor in the local community, but just a really awful, fearful presence at home.
Yeah.
And as she's getting closer and closer to the registrar's office, she's kind of questioning whether it's actually, you know, whether it can be right to impose that legacy onto this kind of gorgeous newborn. And the narrative then splits off into three, depending on the name she does give to him. In one version of their lives, he is Bear, which is the name his elder sister has suggested for him, because she thinks that a boy with that name would be really soft and kind, but also brave and strong. In another version, he's Julian, which is the name his mother set her heart on. It means Sky Father, and she's feeling like she could say it was a tribute to her husband because it's about fathers, but she's also secretly thinking that she kind of hopes he'll be able to rise above this line of awful earth fathers. And then in another version of the story, he's Gordon and named after his father, and really, yeah, just a really troubled figure who's raised in his mold and is kind of quite manipulated by the father. And it follows each version of their lives across 35 years. And I think concentrates really on how a single decision like naming a child can lead to so many different possibilities.
It feels like you really do believe that if you switch name, or the name really does determine quite a lot, but then some of it actually not really.
Yeah, because I think we're all, you know, I'm sure your listeners, for some of them, would feel that their names had very little impact on them, whereas others may be feeling, oh, this really resonates and I know the name, the impact that my name's had on me. But I think one of the interesting things is that actually often we'll never know the impact our names actually had, because so often people will hear our name before ever meeting with us, and they'll bring all their own kind of associations, and whether they're subconscious or conscious, to that. And, you know, that might affect whether we're invited in for a certain job interview or whether we cross paths with a potential partner. And so it has all these different ways of affecting us that we might not even be aware of. But then there are also those conscious ways, which I'm also really interested in.
The 7-year leap, is that to do with that belief that it takes our cells regenerate every 7 years that we essentially become?
Yeah, it's... Exactly that. I don't know how much basis in scientific fact there is for that, but it feels like such a widely held belief that it feels like a really nice place to explore their lives from.
I think I remember looking it up now. It was a couple of months since I read your novel, but I remember looking at the time as to where it takes 7 years for your cell to regenerate. And then in theory, your whole body has different cells from 7 years ago, which is kind of a scary thought, as if you've got a completely different physical makeup. But it was a fascinating way to do. And it's a nice way to move things from 1987 to 2022. It keeps the narrative really hopping along, because you're trying to figure out what's occurred in the 7 years since we last visited. And I think that was kind of, I presume, part of the idea from your point.
Sorry,
of view.
I'm struggling with the line a little bit too.
Oh, apologies for that.
Completely clearly what you said. Oh, that's much better. Thank you.
Apologies for that. I was just talking about the 7 year thing. But look, we'll cut straight to it if you can hear me, because I think the through line in the story is that of domestic violence and the emotional abuse and everything else associated with that in the home. Mm. And it's quite difficult. It's incredibly tense scenes at times during this story.
Mm-hmm. I think what drew me, well, it was odd, because when I set out to write this novel about names, I was actually wanting to write a novel just purely about upbringing and the way it affects us. But about 6 months before I'd started writing, someone who ran a women's refuge and domestic abuse charity had visited a group of women that I was part of, and she talked to us a lot about her work. And the things she told us were so harrowing. It was during the pandemic, and as she was talking, I really struggled not to close the lid of my laptop, because it was so difficult to hear. But I think I tend to process the world either through writing or through reading. And so then those things that I'd heard, I guess, filtered into this story and became something that was a part of it. But I guess because I was thinking, you know, well, I had a lot of basic questions left over that were floating around my mind of, well, what would make someone do that? And why doesn't someone leave? And what's the impact on the children who have that as part of, you know, who grow up in that environment? And so the novel gave me an opportunity to walk alongside Cora and her children and really think about the reasons for that, some of those things.
What's really striking is that her life is idyllic on the surface, isn't it? Because she's married to the local GP. He's highly respected in the area. She has her children. You would think that she has the perfect life.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It does look like that. And I think that's one of the scary things. And also one of the ways in which he isolated her was by making it look to everyone else like there was no cause for concern. Sorry, I was rambling.
No, not at all. It's particularly, he holds her in that kind of emotional prison, doesn't he? Because even when the police come calling, this is used against her, isn't it? Because the policeman is thinking, well, this will be awkward because he's also my doctor, if it turned out to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, I was keen to, I think one of the things that felt really important to me was to take care of the reader in the writing of this novel. And so in the first three chapters, I think they probably are quite harrowing to read, because at that point I was setting out what Gordon, the father, is actually capable of. But I was very keen to, I think domestic abuse can take so many forms, whether that's financial control or shutting down someone's social life or throwing their sanity into question or threatening to take their children away from them. And throughout the novel, I wanted to, or certainly in the two of the narratives, the father doesn't play such a role, but in Gordon's narrative, he does carry on playing a big role. And I wanted to show how each of those levers of control were used against Cora, but also to minimise the exposure that the reader had to those things. So I think there's only one example of each of those things where those things arise after the first three chapters, because there's simply no need to put the reader through more than that.
Mm-hmm. It's subtly and very powerfully done. And I understand you shared the book with somebody from a women's refuge as well.
Yes, she was amazing. So after I'd written about a chapter, I actually got back in touch with Henu Cummings, who was the woman who'd come to speak to us and asked for her advice on just how the kind of dynamic that would form around a character like Gordon. And she really helped me form my ideas of that. And what was really moving for me though was after I'd finished writing and my novel existed as a proof, I showed it to her again. And I'd been very careful not to use any of the examples of domestic abuse that she told me about in the novel because it felt important not to fictionalize real people's lives. Yeah. But when she read it, she's worked with thousands of families across the years. And she said that actually none of the examples of or the particular instance of domestic abuse that are in the novel were new to her. She'd seen all of them.
Wow. And because of the idea of the name and naming the son after the father, you're exploring that idea, the cycle of abuse and trauma, whether particularly boys and men can inherit the traits of abusive parents and also the effect it will have on the girl watching this occur as well.
Yeah. So Maya is 9 years older than her brother, and she's experienced 9 years of living in this household by the time he comes along.
Yeah.
And I think it's made her incredibly watchful and on edge. There's a scene in my book where she's forgotten her PE bag, and Cora, her mum, goes to drop it off for her at school, and the receptionist says, oh, you can take it straight down to her classroom. And when she gets to the classroom, there's this kind of glass panel in the door that she can see through, and she doesn't recognise her own daughter at first because she realises that she's never seen the expression on her face. She's laughing with a friend and she looks so at ease, and she realizes that she never looks that way at home.
Yes.
And I think in that moment Cora realizes that she's doing all she can to try and give her this incredibly loving, stable upbringing, but ultimately it can't compensate for the fear that she's living with. And that's very different from the way her brother's experience of it.
Of interest to us here in Ireland, of course, is the fact that a good chunk of it is set in Ireland. Cora she's from Ireland, and we get to know her mother. And it's a beautiful name, a name I hadn't come across before. Shilva, is that how you're pronouncing it? Because there's an S-I fada L.
Yeah.
And where did you come across that name?
So when I wanted something that, so in English, her name's Sylvia. And when I looked up whether there was an Irish alternative to that, two things came up. One was Shilva and one was Silb. And when I went through it with the kind of copy editors later, we realised that Shilva was probably the more common pronunciation. Although it does sound like, I've met very few people who've heard of it, so it does seem to be an incredibly rare name, but it did exist before I wrote my novel.
I think we found a few in South Africa, quite a lot of names in South Africa of that name. So it has travelled, it seems.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Did you come to Ireland to write that chunk of the book, or what kind of research did you do for that section?
I think I travelled to Ireland in my mind through all the Irish literature that I read. I'm such a huge fan. And I think that the way those writers bring the Irish landscape and those communities and those families and those voices to life meant that when I sat down to write my own characters, and because there are three narratives in my book, I was right from the beginning wanted to relocate one of them to somewhere else, and Ireland felt like the instant choice to me because I felt like, you know, when we read and we imagine these things from these novels, it's almost that they become part of our, you know, the kind of visual dictionary in our head.
Yeah.
And so that was very much there to draw on when I sat down to write my own characters. And I don't know how authentic they will feel to an Irish reader, but in terms of my own mind, they certainly came to life quite easily for me.
Oh, you did a great job. I was convinced that you were half Irish, or you've been living here writing them or something. So that's kind of amazing.
That's so nice to hear.
From over there. Because I know there was one review at the weekend which was suggesting some of the characters spoke in a way that wouldn't be normal here, but I can tell them they're feckin' wrong, essentially.
Oh, I'm so thrilled. You know, it was interesting. The say she actually created a character where Julian uses that word.
Yeah.
And I'd spent quite a long time researching that, and I'd been on kind of websites like Quora and Reddit, and what
Reddit.
I found, it's amazing for a writer to be researching. And what I'd found was that whereas the English just tend to say the straight swear word, which I think in many ways just sounds so much harsher and less palatable, it feels like the Irish have a much more friendly, softer way of doing it, of just slightly changing the swear word so it doesn't feel quite so hard, or at least that's how it sounds to me.
Exactly, yeah. Totally broadcastable, yeah. By the way, which is what I'm saying.
But
I love that in the context of using it, it's two older people expressing love for each other. And it just captured that kind of Irish awkward embarrassment, but also wanting to, convey the sentiment at the same time. Just as feck is a way of swearing without actually swearing. We never quite get to the point. So you could ignore that reviewer's complaint. But it was only a small little complaint they had, to be fair to them. You're going to be invited to Ireland, by the way, for literary festivals and everything when this has come out and people have got their hands on it. Are there other authors here that you've particularly enjoyed?
Yes, a huge number. I adore Claire Keegan. I think she writes quiet stories about quiet people, but does it with such a huge kind of gut punch of emotional power. And I think Alan Murray, who wrote The Coast Road, and Audrey McGee, who wrote The Colony, have that same quality.
The English painter,
at least when I read them.
Who goes to the west of Ireland, yeah.
Yeah. And also kind of, I think probably like the rest of the world, Paul Murray and Sally Rooney. But then, and also Coulter Bean. But then there's a new writer who's just had her debut come out called Claire Gleeson. I read her debut when it was a proof and was just absolutely blown away by it. So Ireland feels like the gift that keeps on giving.
You're really on top of your Irish writers. You'll have to come here at some point.
I have been twice. I came as a teenager, and I came earlier this year. But I suppose in terms of actually writing my novel, it was more informed through my reading of Irish fiction than those visits.
And it goes elsewhere.
But I would absolutely love to go. Pardon?
It goes elsewhere as well. I know we're focusing on Ireland, but the story goes around the place, and it is fascinating.
Well, Ireland felt like as a writer, because Ireland always felt like this lovely, because it revisits each character in turn every 7 years. When I'd restart Julian's chapter and it was in Ireland, it always felt like that, kind of like a real breath of fresh air, and that I'd mentally gone to a different place as well. So it was such a welcome thing in the writing of my novel as well.
And you've got those lovely illustrations at the start of the chapter to remind us of where we are, whether we're with Julian, Gordon, or Bear. Which kind of made it easy to follow. But listen, I'll let you go because you've got a whirlwind of publicity, I'm sure, at your fingertips this week. Good luck with everything. The novel's called The Names. It's out now, published by Phoenix. Florence Knapp, good morning to you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Oliver. It's been lovely to chat.
Thank you. Bye-bye.